Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about the blockbuster Marvel film Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, and then a movie called Ma Belle, Ma Beauty. But let's start off with the Marvel movie, Mike. I saw this in the theater in 3D, and what a fun movie to watch. It goes over the two-hour limit, which I always think is a cardinal sin. You have to really make it worth my while to make me sit there that long, especially since with all Marvel movies, you know you have to stay till the bitter end of those credits because they're going to stick in an extra Easter egg, which, by the way, they do. Don't be tricked into leaving too soon after the first Easter egg because there's another one waiting for you at the very end of the credits. Starting with the runtime, Mike, what did you think of the movie?
For some reason, Marie, not only do I share your interest or near obsession in running time, but like exact running time, 134 minutes. Now, you and I, week by week, oftentimes will complain about films being too long. And in the Marvel universe, the films are often, I think, overloaded. You know, they go on too long, like enough explosions, enough chases, enough anticlimaxes. But this is a case where this is a film that is really entertaining. It's really enjoyable to watch and it's well-paced. And so I didn't mind that running time at all here. It really held my interest. As it gets into those end credits, I want to reinforce Marie's point. You know, in a kind of special effects-driven film particularly, you could have 5 to 10 minutes of credits at the end, but stay in your seat there because you're right. You're going to get what you think is, okay, here's the extra. But then at the very end, and not just, it's no surprise to anyone. This is not a spoiler to say there's going to be a sequel to this film. That, I mean, like duh, you know, almost any Marvel film, you know, it's this, and this would be kicking off a new enterprise. So thematically, to turn on that point, the Marvel universe keeps expanding in various ways, as our universe does, we're told. And my feeling here is that by way of ethnic representation, to put sort of a, you know, stuffy academic phrasing around it, the fact that, you know, you would have an Asian hero. Now, on the one hand, okay, it's a martial arts picture, you know, but on the other hand, so many of these big budget spectacles, you know, traditionally would not have had a protagonist like that. And yet in recent years, and years adding up to more than a decade now, we're increasingly, think Black Panther and on that way, increasingly we're getting superhero type movies in which not just our protagonists, but important supporting players are actors of color, you know, whether Black or Asian or you know, whatever. And I hope we get to the point where I don't have to even talk about this, honestly. In other words, get to the point where it's the norm. Once it's the norm, there'd be no need to point out what I'm pointing out right now. At the moment, I think there's a recognition, not just of equity that we should do this, but also pragmatically of box office. You know, if you look at the American population, you know, the percentages there, yes, there are a lot of Black people going to the movies. There are a lot of Asian people going to the movies, Latino and so on. And I'm not being cynical whatsoever. I simply mean that movie producers are aware of that. They know their audience. They know that, you know, you want to see someone like yourself on screen. I mean, that's a natural impulse. Secondly, they know international distribution because that's what they do. These are movies that play very well overseas, sometimes make a lot more money there even than here in the States. And so it's advantageous to have actors, not just of different nationalities, but overtly so, so that, you know, this is a movie that will open well in China or wherever. That's a big deal. The other observation I'll make before turning it back over is one of my complaints often about the Marvel films, and admittedly, I'm not the biggest fan of the superhero genre, but this is a push come to shove a martial arts picture. And even though it does have a lot of special effects in it, push come to shove, it has actual hand-to-hand combat. It has actual martial arts moves. And so I think it strikes a rather enjoyable balance between what I call traditional hand-to-hand combat. And yes, and I enjoy watching that on screen, I confess. It has a balance between that and what are obviously special effects driven things that, you know, defy the laws of physics. It doesn't push too far with that. By Marvel standards, I think it actually tones down some opportunities where it could have been overloaded with special effects. It keeps the focus on not just actual hand-to-hand combat, but on those people, those characters as people. That's what I really want to say, that, you know, that it's an appealing cast. Let them be human beings and not get lost in the special effects. What do you think?
Well, I am a Marvel movie fan. I don't like all superhero movies, but I do like the franchise. One thing that I was thinking was, it reminded me very much of Crazy Rich Asians from 2018, except this would be crazy underemployed Asians for the two main characters in the movie. And I think that, you know, using stars from Crazy Rich Asians like Awkwafina, Ronnie Chiang, Michelle Yeoh helped this because it already had a built-in audience for people who already liked those actors. And then put it in, like you said, a Marvel universe where, oh, I can go to the movies and see somebody who looks like me. I think that's a huge part of its success. And also, I would say, because Awkwafina really walks off with the movie in terms of getting all the best lines.
She absolutely steals the show, and I'm glad for it. In other words, you know, in any scene, if anyone's getting too serious or pompous or whatever, boy, I'll tell you, she's got the best lines, and she just immediately, you know, puts the pin in that balloon, if you will. She has such a way of deflating anyone's pretensions, and her timing is quite good, actually. So, you know, by way of the premise here, when you have our two leads, Sean and Katie, they work as hotel valets. And there's a lot of opening comedy there of like, you know, like somebody drives up to the hotel in a really fancy car. Oh, let me park that car. No, and then, you know, arguments back and forth. It's really like a vaudeville team trading lines. It's really funny that way. And the fact that, you know, a lot of martial arts pictures, think about Jackie Chan, for instance, so many of the martial arts pictures are done with a real sense of humor. You know, they don't take themselves too seriously. And that's one of the pluses in this film, is that it's just a good-natured film, even when it gets into a potentially heavier family melodrama and you know, gunplay or conflict between groups and so on. And what really carries the film is twofold. Awkwafina, you know, I mean, I loved your references to Crazy Rich Asians, because in the cast, you've got actors like Awkwafina, Michelle Yeoh. I mean, you've got actors that we recognize, and you have a sensibility. These films don't take themselves too seriously. People are trading lines. They're kind of smiling and smirking as they do it. And Awkwafina has the best lines. You're absolutely right. And she's got the best timing. She can, you know, come into a situation and kind of bust up the room. However pretentious somebody might be with a line of dialogue, she'll just cut right through that. So there are two main reasons why I, you know, and I'm not a big fan of the Marvel Universe, as I relentlessly remind people, but this is a film that I found really enjoyable, partly because of that kind of connection of these characters, these actors being appealing, having a good sense of interplay there, there's that. And then secondly, with the martial arts, and I don't just mean the actual action sequences as in the actual hand-to-hand combat, I mean the overall staging of them. And I'll give a couple of examples. Early in the film, our two protagonists are hotel valets, so we're very much in the streets of San Francisco. And there's a scene on a city bus where, you know, it's just really well staged. It's a good, you could put it in one of our film textbooks, like shot by shot, how this thing is put together. And then later in the film, there's a similar in the sense of really elaborately plotted out scene that set in Macau, so other side of the world, if you will. But it's involves some construction scaffolding and the way in which, you know, you, as you're watching it, you can't quite believe what you're watching. And this is an attribute of many, you know, kung fu type movies going back to Bruce Lee and certainly Jackie Chan, overtly comic. You wonder sometimes how much of that stunt work is actually happening and where is their wire work or where is there some kind of nudging with special effects? And I like moments like that where sometimes you're not even entirely sure. Did that guy really jump off the roof? You know, did he really go from here to there? And I like sometimes not being sure. You know, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, however it was done, that they did it. You know, that was really something. So again, when our earlier observation in this program where we talk about running time, which can be excessive, it's not excessive when you get sequences like that that are just pure pleasure to watch. So, you know, I really think, and it underscores why this movie is a genuine box office hit. It's in theaters, so you have to go to theaters. And so the money's coming in at the box office there. The ancillary will be huge when that starts to come in later with streaming. But in any event, the fact that these films typically have really big opening weekends, but then oftentimes just really fall off fast. It partly is for films that are also streaming. People can watch it elsewhere. But this is a film that is in theaters, and people are going in large numbers. And the film, as we speak, has been holding up well from week to week. We'll see how it does. But I think I know this. This is going to be one of the biggest box office films of the year, and deservedly so. And internationally, how could you not enjoy a film like this? And we all need escapism. Even I, as somber and self-serious as I am, I need escapism too. And this film was just an enjoyable 134 minutes. They flew by.
It really does fly by. And I'm not necessarily a fan of kung fu movies. I wouldn't seek one out. So I couldn't tell you whether it was authentic, but it sure was fun to watch. And then it kind of goes into the fanciful, which is where you want it to go, where suddenly now it's a little bit of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where, you know, they're sort of defying some of the laws of physics to make the scene. And you mentioned two of my favorite scenes in the movie. The first is the scene on the bus where Awkwafina ends up having to do the Sandra Bullock speed kind of role where she takes the wheel. And meanwhile, things are just going insane behind her, but she's trying to keep the bus going because I think at one point the brakes are slashed or something. It's a runaway bus. There's an absolutely fabulously shot scene at the very, very end of the bus trip where she's crowded up against the side of the road by a trash truck and just ends up running over all of these parked cars, one right after the other. And it's so outrageous and yet hilarious. It works so, so well. I do want to ask you, Mike, how, if you've seen the movie Nobody, which came out this year too, fabulous bus scene there. So in terms of dueling bus scenes, you know, did you like one better than the other?
Well, they're both very effective scenes. Is this like a subgenre of buses in peril? But in the film we're talking about, it's Awkwafina as much as the bus, right? I mean, you get hurt the wheel that way and you know you're in for a good ride. So I guess if I had to like pick one over the other, I'd pick this one because it can't be denied. It's just, and in fact, it's one reason why, and I'm a big advocate of movie going, of watching films in theaters, a film like this benefits from not only the bigger screen, the full spectacle, if you will, but having an appreciative audience because people are laughing and applauding and it's palpable. I like to use that word. It's palpable. You can just sense that the audience is with it. The audience really likes it.
Yeah. And it is so entertaining in that kind of movie way. I mean, this is the kind of movie that you go to the theaters to see. Don't waste this movie just watching it on a tiny screen. Certainly don't ever watch it on your phone. You really want the sense of bigness that it gives you. And like I said, I saw it in 3D. So in particular, the scaffolding scene in Macau was really effective in 3D because you really get that sense of fear of falling and even a sense of gymnastics that are involved in going from, you know, spot to spot. Really very, very well orchestrated. Like you said, the scenes are just so well thought out and they're so entertaining because it's taking you on this joyride. You're on the scaffolding. You're thinking you're going to fall, or you're on the bus and, you know, you're just trying to write your paper on your laptop and somebody just plugs in a sword for an arm and slices it in half. Some of that stuff also works as comic relief.
Well, comic relief is a good term to use here because you get into some potentially life-threatening situations, a lot of them actually. But when the film doesn't take itself too seriously, yeah, you can get a little nervous or, you know, worked up that way. But frankly, not too much because you know everything will turn out all right for our heroes. You know, these are good people. We care about them. They're going to make it. And so you just enjoy the ride, right? You know, the bus ride, if you will, or the scaffold ride. And so it's never like truly nervous that way. It's more a matter of, you know, how is she going to get through this? How will he survive this? You know, they will, but it's always fun to see the various ways in which the action is staged in which they're able to somehow survive what should not be a survivable situation for almost anyone else.
Now, the other scene I wanted to mention, it's not really a scene, it's more of a scenery, is when they get to the magical land, there's all these really interesting, fantastical creatures, dragons and whatnot. There's even this faceless kind of hassock-shaped character. Now, the scenes where they're riding on the dragons and stuff, I thought was breathtaking, very reminiscent of Game of Thrones. But by the same token, I felt that some of the creatures in that land, I thought they were Pokemon. What did you think?
I agree with you. You know, the film, I hesitate to call it a realistic film in any sense, but the earlier scenes in San Francisco, whatever, I mean, you are kind of grounded in some ways in, you know, an actual reality of your hotel valet and, you know, here's a sports car you want to park. You know, I'm being really mundane because the film has some pleasure just simply of these two contemporary characters navigating the streets of San Francisco. And even when things escalate with the bus and so on, there's still at least a semblance of what life would be like in a city like that. But by the same token, we're getting into a storyline that involves not just conflict between different groups, but a kind of quasi-mystical conflict, the Ten Rings, if you will. It really starts to slide into a sort of mysticism. And where the film lost me a little bit, I'm so glad you mentioned this, Marie, because it was a reservation I had about the film. When you find yourself actually getting, and I'm not going to go into the particulars of how to get into this magic land and so on, because you want to discover these things for yourself as you're watching it. But as I get into the sort of magic kingdom, it gets a little too cutesy for my taste. The creatures, it's almost like the bar scene in the original Star Wars, where it's like, oh my goodness, look at this creature and look at that one. And they are kind of fascinating by way of like, a creature without a face or this or that. But to my way of thinking, you're right, Marie, it gets a little Pokemon-ish. Can I say Pokemon-ish? I don't usually phrase it that way, but you know what I'm getting at. It just gets a little too cute, a little too precious that way. And I think the film suffers from that because that's the point where even though I'm in this magic world and I'm primed to believe whatever I'm watching, I'm not really quite believing some of that. You know what I'm getting? It's sort of a weird thing to talk about. Like, I'm not quite believing some of that because it seems too much like the people have made up these elaborate costumes for the critters or the computers made them up. And to have our protagonists interact with them, I don't know, to me, it's just a bit saccharine at that point. And I want the film to have a little more spirit. It doesn't have to be naturalistic and can still be supernatural, but I don't want it to be sort of like just sitting and smiling. It's like a sugar rush kind of moment. You know what I'm getting at? It just seems a little too sweet in some of the staging there. Is that sort of what you're getting at? Because that's certainly my take on it.
I think summing it up as Star Wars Cantina was actually right on the money because it is like that. It's like, ooh, look how unusual that character is, and look how unusual that character is, rather than it just sort of blending in, like, well, of course, that's what dragons look like. And that's what you would expect, the animals to look like and act like. I want to make sure we mention Tony Leung, who plays in this. We mentioned other actors, but he, I think, is the most recognizable to our students because he's been in so many movies that we use in class, such as Infernal Affairs. And of course, at least referentially, and Lust, Caution, and In the Mood for Love. Incredible actor. I mean, everything he does is worth watching. But in this, I'm kind of surprised that they got him, talked him into doing this role.
Well, he plays the father. He's the patriarch, if you will. And he's not the most loving of fathers, certainly not the kindest and gentlest of fathers. And so the family melodrama, which you should discover on your own, is very much a story of that parental figure and the children, our protagonist and the sister. And you really need to, like, as you watch it, realize that for all the silliness of the film, there are some genuine family conflict related moments there of, a really stern paternal figure. And then, how the kids would try to break away from that and want to live, quote unquote, normal lives and not be pulled into the world represented by their father. One thing I'll quickly say on a sort of demographic note, and I mean demographics of screen representation here, I haven't read the source comic books from the 1970s, but from what I've read about them, the father figure there had an almost Fu Manchu quality. What I'm getting at is stereotypically, when we think of the exotic East, when we think of Orientalism, all the terms we use in academia to talk about this, but the way in which Western readers and viewers would think about the mysterious East, it oftentimes does resort to stereotypical images of that, really kind of reductive and sometimes even insulting. And also, when you think of Hollywood film history, Charlie Chan type things, where sometimes you watch those movies now and, oh my goodness, they're not exactly politically correct in various ways. And you can kind of grimace a bit as you watch them. What I find significant by way of movie going demographics, movie making demographics, if they were truly faithful to the 70s comic books, as I understand them to have been, you would have had a kind of Fu Manchu character, like a conventional villain, an Asian villain figure. And in this film, that gets so toned down, even though he's really severe, you never feel like you're watching a live action comic book figure. You can really believe in him as a strict father whose beliefs I might challenge, and I certainly don't like the way he treats the kids and so on. But the fact that, in his own way, he has a sense of dignity and a sense of what's right, and within his attachment to the supernatural world of what they should be doing and how life should be and so on. And watching it again, I never felt like it was any ever derogatory. I never felt like in any way it was, somehow making fun of him as an Asian villain, which, in earlier decades, I think the film might well have done. What do you think, Marie? Because I think it's a significant shift now, not only to have this focus on principal characters being Asian, but in a more realistic, if you will, more dignified way, certainly.
I think you're right about that. I think that may be why Tony Leung was a genius choice, because he's got the gravitas, where he comes across as someone to be taken seriously and in all of his roles, including this one. I will also mention that as an archer, I loved the scenes with Awkwafina and the flaming arrows. I'm sitting there thinking, I got to get me some flaming arrows. That's what I need. So just to wrap up talking about this movie, What are your thoughts, Mike, on why this is so successful and works so well when Black Widow tanked?
Well, the thing is, Black Widow, actually, I was thinking about Black Widow as I was talking about this movie doing so well at the box office. Black Widow opened really well, had a big, big theatrical opening, and then it fell off very quickly. And there are two reasons or two lines of thought on that. One is that the film itself is rather disappointing, which I think it is. It's not one of the strongest films of that genre, of that type. But then secondly, because that, you know, that was a film that was also available for streaming. And you can make a, and they make a lot of money off of that. So I'm not feeling sorry for them that way. But it takes money from the box office take. And, you know, and of course, Scarlett Johansson actually, you know, had a lawsuit or has one going there, because when she signed her contract, it was, I think, pre-pandemic when she signed it. But it was predicated on, you know, actors nowadays make a big paycheck up front, but they stand to make even more money at the back end of the deal. Namely, you know, here's your salary to make the movie. And then based on box office, you get a certain percentage of it. So when the box office, and this is theatrical box office, fell off so quickly, her profit, you know, sort of went down as well. And she's not going to make as much or much of anything from streaming there. But Marie, let me get your thoughts on this too, because it seems to me that it's a good contrast there, because this film that we're talking about today, it's just really a pleasure to watch. Black Widow, I'm shrugging my shoulders the same way I did as I watched it. I think it's a mediocre film, and for various reasons in terms of how the films are being released, how they were released, but more importantly, you know, on the thematic, just on a viewing level, this one's fun to watch. The other one was meh.
Yes, that is exactly it. This movie is really fun to watch. And I think it's because it focuses so well on the action, where Black Widow tried to focus a lot more on the emotions of the characters. And that's why I think it fell flat. If they'd had more excitement, like we see in this movie, I think it might have done better.
Marie, I don't think the actors in the other film were as involved. It seemed to me that like they were sort of going through the motions. What do you think about that? Because in this film, they're fully committed to it. In that film, I felt like they're getting their paycheck. They're doing what they're supposed to. They're fine. They're okay, right? But there wasn't anything ever mesmerizing or really compelling. What do you think of those central performances?
I agree with you completely, because Florence Pugh walks off with that movie, leaves Scarlett Johansson just in the dust. So yes, I think there was a lack of conviction in that movie, where this Shang-Chi is all conviction, at least for the purposes of the movie. Like you said, some of it is a little far-fetched and fantasy-like, but it's all in this to tell a fun story and have a good time at the movies. So that brings us to our second film, which is an artsy film that I saw at Sundance called Ma Belle, My Beauty. And, you know, at Sundance, the director, Marion Hill, was talking about how much she enjoyed making this movie, what a personal story it was. And for those of you who don't know anything about this movie, it's about three people who used to be involved in a polyamorous relationship, two women and a man. One of the women kind of leaves the couple, the remaining two get married. And then the husband invites the old girlfriend to come visit them in the south of France. I think it's the south of France. And then it's supposed to be this groundbreaking movie for queer cinema to show polyamory and, you know, make a mainstream kind of movie about it. So starting off with those criteria of what it's about, Mike, how well do you think this movie did as achieving what it was set out to do?
I really don't like this film particularly. I wanted to like it. The premise is quite interesting, that the three main characters had a polyamorous relationship. And now, you know, some years have gone by, they're being reunited. Where are they now? What I found intriguing about that was the fact that it was not treated in an exploitative or quote unquote shocking way. It was very matter of fact. The three of them had this relationship, and now here they are in the south of France, staying in a villa. So nice scenery, even if I'm not thrilled with the film otherwise. It's nice to sit at the table, right, when you're in the south of France and have some wine. What I found disappointing about the film was the fact that it has a slow pace. It's kind of dull, to put it bluntly. And what really bothered me about the film was what I call fuzziness. By that, I mean, the film is so, not quite ambiguous, but it just doesn't like fully delve into, well, what was that relationship like for the three of them years ago? What are their connections like today? It really just kind of like slides around a lot of those thematic points. It really kind of loses focus, frankly. It just, and that makes it dull after a while. If you have people who had a relationship and now they're not quite sure what they have, when they're just walking around with glasses of wine and, you know, wandering and making oblique comments, at a certain point, not quite that I go to sleep, but that I just sort of like lose interest a bit. I'm not particularly drawn to these characters, and the dialogue is not especially trenchant or perceptive. It sort of skirts the issue. It sort of dances around what I think should be at the heart of the film. At some point, you need really direct give and take, as in, this is what we were like, here we are now. It's so oblique at times that way, that even though I should appreciate the fact that it's not thematically clubbing us over the head, it goes too far in the other direction. Now, it's a debut film for Marian Hill. I think there's some potential talent there. I just think that this particular film, Ma Belle, Ma Beauty, is not fully realized. I think it's kind of sketched out. And as I keep saying, there's a kind of sketchiness to the characters. And for me, emotionally, after about an hour or so, I really lost interest. I mean, I'm watching every moment of it, but I'm not really that interested in it anymore. And I'm just kind of marking time. And thank goodness again for the south of France. Yes, I don't mind, wandering through that scenery, but the human beings in it, don't care so much.
Sketchy is the perfect way to describe it, because it does seem like a sketch that's not quite fleshed out enough. For example, the woman Birdie and all the actors in it are perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with the quality of the acting. I think it's the script that lets them down. But, you know, you find yourself, you know, the woman who's actually in the triangle, she's married to this guy and he's invited their old girlfriend. And then a fourth woman shows up too. Yeah. I just find myself thinking, what does she see in either one of these people? Either, you know, the ex or her husband. They're just not portrayed in any sort of appealing way. Like you said, it's just sort of meh. And it doesn't provide enough tension for you to be concerned about what's going to happen next. And in fact, the Lane character, I thought, was basically an emotional state expressed through agonizing, intense, longing glances rather than a character. I think that was the main problem I had with it. But last thought, Mike, I really enjoyed a movie similar to this, Call Me By Your Name. And I kind of expected that this was going to be like that. And it just never delivered on the promise of the synopsis.
Comparisons have been made between those two films. Call Me By Your Name is a film I love. I think it's a really beautifully made film, extremely well acted. I cared about those characters. That's a case where you'd also have some kind of fluid relationships and some ambiguity. But you know what? These are fully realized characters. And the filmmakers and the actors are so completely committed that you really can understand them as people and the complexity of their relationships. Whereas, Marie, the word you and I keep using for Ma Belle is that there's that sketchiness. You feel like it's working towards something like that. So push come to shove, this is an easy statement to make, that Call Me By Your Name is a really strong film. This film we're talking about now, comme ci, comme ça. I mean, I didn't mind watching it, but it was not particularly a compelling viewing experience.
Comme ci, comme ça is a perfect way to sum up that movie. And that brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find them under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.